You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And TGIF, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. It's Friday. Of course, that means it is Brunch with Bernie. Senator Bernie Sanders taking your calls in our national town hall meeting. Senator Sanders, welcome. Senator Sanders? Is he there? He just dropped. He just vanished from the board. I think his telephone line must have croaked. Okay. We'll try dialing him back, and he'll try dialing us back, and we'll get him on. Not to worry. We'll make it work. So, anyhow, we'll be back with Bernie in just a few minutes. And in the meantime, did you see the news about Halliburton? This is incredible. Halliburton is going to use 23 seconds worth of their profits to pay a $200,000 fine to make the charges go away for destroying the evidence that they had found about themselves. Ah, Senator Sanders is back with us. I'll finish this riff in the next hour. Senator Sanders, welcome. Still not getting him. Do we have a cable problem? A line problem? Bernie? Oh, I do not understand what's going on here. Okay, it has been the week for technical difficulties. We will figure this out. Is it possible that a cable has been changed around here or something? I mean, I was just talking to him on the phone. We're going to figure this out. So back to Halliburton and my rant about Halliburton. The Halliburton, you know, they provided the cement for the outside of the sheath of this hole that got drilled for the Mercado well, you know, the thing that blew out, the BP well that blew out, that killed 11 men. And they ran some simulations about what happens if we do this way, which involved having 6 spacers rather than 23 spacers that keep the center away from the edge of this thing. Anyhow, without getting too technical about it, they ran some simulations. They gathered some information about how much fault they had for the death of these 11 men and for the incredible pollution of the Gulf of Mexico. And when all was said and done, they discovered, oddly enough, something that they didn't want anybody else to know. And so they ordered their own scientists to destroy their own data. So when the federal government came along and said, okay, turn over your data to us, you know, what were your assumptions? What were your math? What was your math? Halliburton said, sorry, we destroyed that. You know, the dog ate our homework. And so let's try this again. And they're paying a $200,000 fine for it. Senator Sanders, I'm not hearing him. I'm not hearing anything when I put him on. It's like our phone line, our phone system there's something weird. Okay, we are going, Bernie, if you can hear me, we're going to reboot our phone system. And we must have some kind of a problem here. Whatever it is, I'm going to reboot mine. So anyway, this raises a really interesting question. Why is it that corporations are constantly getting away with these kind of things? And 11 people dead. 11 people dead and hundreds of millions of dollars of damage, billions of dollars of damage, tens of billions of dollars, maybe more, of damage done in the Gulf of Mexico. Not to pollution and things like that. Not to mention wiping out people's livelihoods. Not to mention all the hundreds of, or tens of thousands or more of human cancers that are going to come down the road as a consequence of all these hydrocarbons being in our food chain, as a consequence of this being dumped into the Gulf. I mean, there's something really weird. Hang on. Hey, Shane, you want to make sure that this has nothing to do with our using the studio for that other show? No. Okay. That doesn't. Okay. So, and anyhow, back to my Halliburton rant here. So three companies were involved in this: Transocean, Halliburton, and British Petroleum, or BP. I guess they're no longer called British Petroleum, it's BP. BP is paid a fine. Transocean paid a fine. I think it was $4.5 billion dollars, as I recall. It was a substantial fine. Halliburton, Dick Cheney's company, which actually did the cementing into the well, is going to pay a fine of $200,000. And it was suggested very early on, and has, to the best of my knowledge, never been seriously refuted, that the cementing failed in a way that caused this well to erupt in a way that killed these 11 guys. Now, maybe that's not the case. Maybe the government has decided, okay, the cement had nothing to do with it, that it was the blowout preventer failing, pure and simple. But whatever it is, how is it that a company can destroy their own evidence of, you know, presumably, and tell me when to reboot this software here on this end. Did you say, was that open it now? Okay. Whoops. How can it be that a company can destroy evidence, their own evidence, of possibly their own crimes, and pay a $200,000 fine? I really think we need to go back to the 19th century corporate rules that we had that said that when a corporation commits a crime, when a corporation kills people, when a corporation does something egregious, the corporation gets the death penalty. We dissolve the corporation, the shareholders get stuck. Hey, that was the risk you took when you invested in the company. Investment's all about risk, right? The shareholders are, you know, get stuck holding the bag. The corporation gets dissolved. Its assets get sold off. And that's the end of that. So, you know, the other thing, Danielle, we may want to try and do is with a different phone line, call into our system and just try putting you on the air for a second and just make sure that we've got a continuous line here. Just, you know, make sure that I don't have anybody on my board yet. Yeah, he's not showing up on my board. So there's nothing. It's totally blank on my board. Oh, there we go. Line 11 just showed up. And
hello?
Hey, I hear you, Bernie. Hallelujah.
Hey, Tom. How are you?
Fine. Okay, we just have a minute and a half, I think, or so here until the break.
The thing about technology, it's fantastic when it occasionally works.
Yes, and then it doesn't.
Let me run through. We don't have much time.
Sure.
There's a lot that went on in the Senate this week, and I'll try to very, very briefly go through it. The great debate about student loans. I voted against the bill that eventually passed, offered an amendment to try to improve it. Bottom line is, it is now going to be based on variable interest rates. So as interest rates go up in years to come, which is very, very likely, it means that students and their parents will be paying substantially higher interest rates than they're paying right now. Right. I think given the disaster we currently have in terms of student indebtedness, the average student is $28,000 in debt when he or she graduates college. That is a bad, bad idea. We're working now. There's going to be work begun on the Senate Finance Committee on tax reform, and I have a lot of concerns about the possibilities as to where that might go. The committee will be deluged with the needs and the pressure from large corporations who would like to see even more tax breaks than they currently have. I found it interesting that the chairman of the committee promised that the requests coming in, the proposals coming in from members of the Senate, would not be released publicly for 50 years, 50 years. Why
wow.
is that? Because I think you're going to see many proposals coming in that are asking for very strong special interest breaks for large multinational corporations that members are embarrassed about.
Yeah. We'll pick this up right after
okay.
the break. We'll build it a little more time for a summary of the news here. Stick around. We'll be right back. It's 15 minutes past the hour. Brunch with Bernie here on the Tom Hartman Program.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And, of course, we're taking your calls now for the senator. And after he gets done with his summary of the news, we will pick them up. Trying on his past the hour brunch with Bernie. Senator Bernie Sanders on the line in our national town hall meeting. Senator, is there any recapping that you wanted to do of the news here before we get into it?
I touched on what I thought some of the issues are. Student loans, the need to improve a situation which today is a disaster, making it very, very difficult for low and moderate income kids to afford to go to college. I think the current bill the bill that was just passed in the Senate, supported by the Obama administration and the Republican Party very strongly, makes a bad situation worse. What was interesting about the vote on that one is every Republican in the Senate except one voted for it, and we had, I believe, 16 or 17 of the most progressive members of the Senate who voted against it.
Wow.
And what does that tell you about the nature of the bill?
Yeah, that's not good news. Not good news for students. So would you like to pick up phone calls?
Let's do it.
Okay. John in Putney, Vermont, you are on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hey, Senator Sanders, proud to have you as our senator from Vermont. Tom opened the show talking about Halliburton and some finagling they did with some records to try to get out of being responsible for the something down with the spill in New Orleans. But which brought me to the point of thinking, once again, here's big business, a huge corporation playing games with the system. And it brought me to a place of that I come to often, thinking about the Exxon Valdez and what Exxon has done over the years. They awarded that town, a judge awarded that town, which was destroyed financially by that spill, $5 billion. The last I heard, in fact, a man has written a book about it, they had whittled it down into the millions, destroyed the town, destroyed it. Any means of income.
Because, John, do you have a question for Bernie?
Yeah. I was wondering if he has any idea, sorry for rattling on that,
okay,
about whether they actually were ever awarded anything because they kept it in the courts for over 20 years.
John, that's an excellent question, and I don't know the answer to it. But the point that you are making is that even when a judgment is levied against a large corporation, they have so much money, they have so many lawyers, that they can keep appealing and appealing and appealing and end up paying much, much less than the original sum that the courts determined. And it's the same old story. And when you're talking about a company like ExxonMobil, you're talking about the most profitable corporation in the history of the world, ripping people off at the tax pump, and despoiling our environment. John, that is the point that you raise, is a very, very important one.
Leah Marie in
Tucumcari,
New Mexico?
Yeah, that's right. You got it. Okay, so Senator Sanders, I was wondering if you could please comment about, and I think it's kind of the same thing with New Orleans, but the comment on what happened in Detroit and how the big three automakers basically helped contribute to the downfall of Detroit, because to me it's really horrifying what happened there.
Well, it's, Leah, thanks. Leah Marie, thank you very much for the question. Actually, it was interesting. I was in Detroit a couple of months ago because we're looking at the issue of youth unemployment, which is off the charts in Detroit. And I talked to a whole lot of really decent kids trying to do the right thing, high school graduates, maybe some with a little bit of college. The best that they can find in Detroit's economy today are jobs at fast food places at 7 1/4 an hour, minimum wage, and they can't even get 40 hours a week. Now, what happened to Detroit has a lot to do with the deindustrialization of the United States of America, the fact that we've lost well over 50,000 factories in the last 10 years, the fact that 30, 40 years ago we led the world in automobile manufacturing. Now the Germans produce twice as many automobiles as we do. The fact that, among other things, it's cheaper for the big three to be manufacturing cars in Mexico. They're moving into China itself, et cetera, et cetera. All of which takes us to the disastrous trade policies, permanent normal trade relations with China, NAFTA, etc., that corporate America has forced on the Congress and the presidents of the United States in recent years. But the challenge, Leah Marie, is a very, very simple one. In my view, the middle class does not recover in this country unless you have a strong manufacturing sector, unless we once again are producing the products that the American people consume, including automobiles. And the demand has got to be made on American corporations, including the big three, to produce in this country. But it's not limited to the automobile industry. It's, of course, every major corporation has not only downsized, but they've outsourced a lot of their production abroad. It is a huge issue. We've got to bring the American people together on that demand. Corporate America has got to rebuild our manufacturing sector here in the United States of America, pay workers a decent wage. What happened to Detroit is a real, real tragedy, but it is not just Detroit. We're seeing millions and millions of workers in recent years who have lost decent-paying jobs. They're now scrambling to try to make a living working at McDonald's, Burger King, Walmart. Very hard to do that.
Bernie, 45 seconds to the break. What do you see happening in terms of trade and trade policy over the next few years?
Well, the new trade agreement that's coming up is the trade agreement with the Pacific Rim, Vietnam, and other Asian countries, which I think is pretty much more of the same. That particular trade agreement is being written in secrecy by corporate America. And I fear that it will have, continue to have, a negative impact on not only, working class Americans, but also in terms of some of the pharmaceutical aspects of the, bill, negative impacts on low income people, in Asia.
Depressing news. Senator Bernie Sanders with us. Check out his website, sanders.senate.gov. He's got the Bernie Buzz, great newsletter. It's a great news site, updated every single day. And you can communicate with Senator's office that way. And you can call in here on our national town hall meeting, Brunch with Bernie. We'll be back in just a moment. More of Senator's.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Once again, Bernie's website, sanders.senate.gov. 28 minutes past the Welcome back, Tom. I'm here with you, and it's our Brunch with Bernie hour. Senator Bernie Sanders taking your calls in our national town hall meeting. Senator, you're still here?
I am right here.
Okay.
Technology is hanging in.
It is. The cans and the string and the mouse and the wheel and the whole bit, it's all working. Okay, Liz in West Hollywood, California. You are on the air, Senator Sanders.
Hi, good morning, Sanders. Senator Sanders, or afternoon. I understand, I read that or saw on television that the post office was the first agency to require seatbelts in the cars, and that subsequently led to all of us having the safety of seatbelts. So my question is about computer chips. Why are they made in China? Why isn't the Congress demanding that any chip that's made has to be made in the United States so we can ensure our own security?
Well, Liz, that is a very, very good question. It touches just on an issue that we dealt with a few moments ago. One of the reasons that the middle class in this country is disappearing has to do with the decline of manufacturing. It used to be a time when, you know, folks who didn't have a whole lot of education go into a factory, if they had a union behind them especially, earn good wages, good benefits. To a significant degree, those days have passed. And what we have seen in recent years is corporate America saying, look, why do I want to pay an American worker $15 or $20 an hour, provide health care, protect environmental laws, when I can go to China, Vietnam, Mexico, other lower-wage countries, and employ hard-working people at a fraction of the wages? That has been the plan of corporate America going 30, 40 years ago. That is what they have successfully pushed through, so that every major corporation in America, including the big high-tech companies, the iPhone that you have in your hand, the components were manufactured in China, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And it gets back to the point that I made a moment ago. In my view, if we are going to rebuild the middle class, if we're going to create decent-paying jobs, we must rebuild the manufacturing sector, which means that we need fundamental changes in our trade laws, permanent normal trade relations with China, NAFTA, CAFTA, etc.
Gabriel in Boise, Idaho.
Hello.
You are on the air,
hi.
Gabriel.
Oh, fantastic. Here, can you hear me a little better?
Hear you just fine.
Hello, Bernie, Mr. Senator. Thank you very much. My question is, how do we convince the 99% group to learn from what happened in the 80s? In the 80s, the Reaganites basically said, go get a job. It doesn't matter if it's a dog catcher. Go run for election. Get anything. And that seems like how they put us in this position now, is because that's what they did. How do we convince the groups that are already working today to do that?
Are you talking about the Republicans got Republicans in political office?
Right.
They did. Okay, got it.
Okay, Gabriel raises a very, very important question. Way back when, we're going back now, I think, Tom, to Lyndon Johnson's victory in 1964.
Mm-hmm.
The Republican Party and their moneyed interests sat around and said, you know what? We're losing really, really badly. How do we reconstitute the Republican Party? What do we do to make sure that our voice is heard significantly in the radio, talk radio, television? What do we do about building, as Gabriel indicates, a grassroots movement? How do we make sure that our money goes in the right direction to protect the interests of the wealthy and the powerful? And out of that came a huge strategy, which has changed over the years, but it has been enormously successful. The bottom line is you have a party today, the Republican Party, which is a right-wing extremist party, whose views, this is not Bernie Sanders talking, you just look at the polls out there. Virtually every one of their major tenets, cutting Social Security or privatizing Social Security, giving more tax breaks to billionaires, working against the environment, opposing the raising of the minimum wage, asking for major cuts in Medicare and Medicaid. These are ideas that are opposed not just by progressives, they're opposed by Republicans, they're opposed by moderates, they're opposed by people all across the country. And the issue that Gabriel raises, very profound issue, how does a party which maybe has 10, 15, 20% support ideologically among the American people end up controlling the U.S. House of Representatives, governor seats all over this country? How do they manage to do that? And the answer is they have been very, very smart starting at the grassroots level. They have had people, and I think this is Gabriel's point, running for school board, running for city council, starting at low levels of government and working their way up. And I think if Gabriel's point is that the progressive community has got to do the same thing, got to get their hands dirty, get involved in local politics. It's not easy. It's not easy winning elections. It's not easy being on a city council or a school board. It's tough work, and often there is very little or no pay at all. But if we are going to be successful in rallying the American people, we need a progressive agenda which stands for working families and the middle class, and we need people to help implement that agenda at the local level, at the state level, and at the national level.
Okay. Hang on just a second here. Cindy in Fort Madison, Iowa. Hey, Cindy, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Thank you so much for taking my call. Senator Sanders, it's a pleasure to talk to you, and I'm hoping you can give me some advice on this new Obamacare that is supposed to be coming into effect hopefully soon. Every year, my health care insurance continues to rise, and it's almost as high as your house payments now. I'm hoping that it is going to go down, and I don't understand how this is going to work, where because I don't think the insurance company is going to send you a letter saying, oh, your rates are going down, you know.
Cindy, are you, do you get individual coverage?
Yes, okay. I do.
All right, here's what the story is, and I voted for Obamacare. I voted for it because it will bring some 30 million uninsured Americans into health care. We've managed to get a whole lot of money for community health centers, for the National Health Service Corps, a lot of good things at disease prevention. But I will tell you, as a strong advocate of a single-payer system, that the current Obamacare program is much more complicated than it should be. But, Cindy, in terms of your particular case, what it means, and I'm not sure how it's being implemented in Iowa, What it means is that depending on your income, you will be able to see on your on a website the competing programs that are available to you in the state of Iowa, and you will make the best choice based on your needs. And the belief is, and we've seen this being true in California and I believe in New York State as well, that because individuals now have got to have some form of health insurance and the pool is becoming wider, we're seeing a drop in what insurance companies are charging individual consumers. Furthermore, depending on your income, you will also be eligible for a federal subsidy. So the hope, at least, and it's certainly appears to be true in California already, is that because more people are in the pool, your insurance rates from the competing insurance companies should go down, and B, depending on your income, if you're low or moderate income, it is very likely you will get an additional subsidy from the federal government. That is the theory. In many cases, it is working. We'll see how this whole thing plays out.
Mike, in Hempstead, New York, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yes, Senator Sanders, I just want to thank you for your service.
Thank you, Mike.
First off, you're welcome. And also, you're a voice of sanity in this crazy corporate greed wilderness. And that's a point I have, and then a quick question. It's basically all corporate greed, and they're the ones running the show right now. And to me, the Supreme Court has also helped that along, of course, starting with Reaganomics and the Glass-Steagall and all that. But how come Obama's not, and if that would be, I think, the answer to some of it at least, or starting the ball rolling, to getting the Supreme Court leaning the opposite ways since it's been leaning conservatively. It should be leaning fairly and, I think, progressively to the left by replacing possibly Kennedy.
Mike, we have just a minute. Let's let Bernie
answer. Mike, the short answer to your question, obviously, is the president can't appoint people until there are vacancies, and he has appointed some reasonably good justices since he's been in office. If vacancies arrive, you know that the Supreme Court is now tilting 5-4 right wing, and my hope and expectation is that if one of the justices, the more conservative justices, retires, that he will replace that justice with a more progressive justice. But in terms of your first point about corporate greed, you hit the nail on the head. What we right now have is a corporate world that could care less about the average American. Their goal is short-term profit. Wall Street is living in a world unto itself, and unless we address that issue, I have not a whole lot of hope about the economic well-being of the middle class of this country.
We'll be back in just a minute with more of your calls for Senator Bernie Sanders in our Brunch with Bernie Hour here on the Tom Hartman Program. Check out Bernie's website at sanders.senate.gov.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit tomhartman.com for audio and video archives.
It's 15 minutes before the top of the hour. Again, Bernie's website, sanders.senate.gov. Occupying the media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Tom Hartman here with you, and it is our Brunch with Bernie hour. Senator Bernie Sanders taking your calls. Joan in Alexander, North Carolina. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yes, Senator Sanders. As I understand it, Obamacare goes into effect in October of this year and will be required to get health insurance, which my husband and I don't have. And if the governor here, McCrory, has decided not to accept Obamacare or institute it, I assume that means that there would be no federal assistance for getting health care.
Yes.
And therefore, we'd be charged with what, a crime?
No. No. You would not be charged with a crime if your state was not involved in the program. The point is what Obamacare, the two important parts of two of the important parts of Obamacare is, number one, to expand Medicaid to 15 million people who today are not eligible for that. Now, I don't know what your income is, Joan, but if the state of North Carolina got into the program, you might well be eligible for Medicaid, which would not cost you a nickel. The other part is another 15 million people will be able to get health care through the exchange in, depending on their income, fairly heavily subsidized rates. So people get a pretty good deal for health care. But if North Carolina is not in the program, you're not going to be held responsible.
Okay. That's a very interesting question. Jim, in Littleton, Colorado, you're on the air with Senator Sanders. Jim?
Oh, shoot.
You're on the air.
Actually, it's Lone Tree. I had a question for you, Senator. Why don't we go to a 32-hour work week and if to stop them from manipulating the system, make overtime double time, and get rid of business having to deal with health care and switch it over to, like, in the insurance system, get rid of Medicare, Medicaid, and legislate the insurance companies into taking in everybody. And that way we take that burden off business.
All right. Well, Jim, you've just proposed a revolution in the United States, probably not going to pass by the United States Congress, who are heavily dominated by corporate interests. Let me just touch on a few of your points. We are the only nation in the industrialized world that does not guarantee health care to all people through a national health care program. The result is that we spend almost twice as much as any other country. Our outcomes are not particularly good, and tens of millions of people have no health insurance at all. Ours is the most complicated, wasteful health care non-system in the entire world. And what Jim focuses on, he makes a good point. You know, why is it that businesses themselves have got to supply health care to their employees? This came about during World War II for a variety of reasons that we don't have the time to go into now, but there is no rational reason for that. Health care should be a right of all people, paid for by tax dollars, administered in an efficient way by the government. The United Kingdom does that. Canada does that. Denmark does that. Countries all over the world do that. And the result is systems that are much more cost-effective and much more universal and allow, importantly, businesses to do what they're supposed to do, that is to function on what they do, rather than get involved very heavily in the complicated and expensive issue of providing health care. So the answer to your question is, Jim, you're right. It should not be businesses providing health care. It should be the United States government through a national health care program, in my view, a single-payer system.
Marcia, in Englewood, Florida, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi, I love both of you. I'm just so confused by the conflicts in Congress, and most especially with President Obama, the mixed signals that I get from all of them about what direction we're heading, what we should be heading in, and especially with Obama promising all this transparency in government and doing the total opposite.
Okay, Marcia, let me jump in. Very, very good question, and let me try to explain it as best I can from my perspective, at least. Here's what you got in Washington right now, and I'm probably the only member of Congress who will tell you this. On one hand, you have a Republican Party that has become moved away from being kind of a moderate conservative party years ago to a right-wing extremist party. What do I mean by that? What I mean by that is you have many people in the Republican Party who now, for example, not only oppose raising the minimum wage, which virtually all of them do, you have most of them now believe that we should abolish the concept of the minimum wage, that if workers, say, in a high unemployment area like Detroit would work for $3 or $4 an hour, then that would be fine. No government protection in terms of what a minimum wage should be. There are many Republicans who not only believe in cutting Medicare and Medicaid, they believe that it is unconstitutional for the United States government to be involved in health care at all. Only the private sector insurance companies should be doing that. So you've got a right-wing extremist party, heavily dominated and funded by corporate interests like the Koch brothers. Then you've got a Democratic Party that has also moved pretty far to the right, is now, instead of being a party that it was, say, under Roosevelt and Truman, a party really identified with the working class of this country, has become kind of a moderate party, a centrist party, good on a number of issues, gay rights, women's rights, some degree to the environment, but also heavily dominated by corporations in terms of economic issues. Much better than the Republicans, to be sure, but not terribly strong in fighting for working people. And you have Obama, who is a centrist Democrat. So in terms of the economic struggle, which is how you take on Wall Street and the big money interest and deal with the decline of the middle class, the very high level of poverty, deal with the incredible power, both wealth and power, that corporate America and Wall Street have, should we expect that the president will really take on those very powerful special interests? And it's not going to happen. That's not where he is about. He will be somewhere in the middle, a fight for raising the minimum wage, for doing this, that, and the other thing, but not really lead the frontal attack that we need. So that's kind of politically where I see us at this particular moment.
Thank you, Bernie. Thank you so much for being with us today.
All right. My pleasure, Tom.
Thank you, Sam. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. This is the Tom Hartman Program, broadcasting on commercial radio stations from coast to coast, on Sirius XM all across the North American continent, on Pacifica stations across America, Europe, and Africa, on American Forces Radio and every U.S. military base in the world, and simulcast as television on both Dish Network, DirecTV, and cable systems nationwide by the Free Speech TV Network. And with us now is Professor Charles Lewis, Executive Editor of the Investigative Reporting Workshop, the American University School of Communication, Professor of Journalism, and author of 5 books. InvestigativeReportingWorkshop.org is the website. Professor Lewis, welcome to the program.
Well, thanks for having me.
So you've done some, you and the folks in your workshop have done some pretty remarkable work on what the Koch brothers are up to with regard to, in particular, buying off higher education. Can you, what and organizing nonprofits? What's the situation? Where are we at? What have they been doing, and how did it get here?
Well, as you know, Koch Industries is one of the largest privately held companies in the world. They have been politically active in the traditional ways, campaign contributions and other things, for many, many years. Increasingly over the last basically almost 20 years, and I've actually tracked them for several years, they have gotten deeper and deeper into other types of influence, not just political influence, say, with Congress. And so they what we showed in what we called the Koch Club is we looked at their political contributions, their lobbying contributions, or lobbying expenditures, rather. We looked at their money going to universities, and we looked at their money to 89 public policy-type nonprofits that are lobbying on and talking publicly and educating the public about things that their own companies, commercial lobbyists, are also lobbying about. All of these things involve lots of money, of course, about $134 million in just a 5-year period, or the last 5 years that you could track. And I should say, this is not illegal. This is entirely legal in the United States. This is philanthropy, self-interest of a company, the fifth and sixth or something like that, wealthiest people on planet Earth exerting their influence, a 160,000 employee, $115 billion company. And what makes Koch unusual is I'm not aware of another U.S.-based corporation that goes to these lengths and is this across the board thorough in putting forward their views and their policies and their ideologies. But the ideologies line up very nicely with the agenda of the company, as a matter of fact.
Can you give me an example of that, sir?
Well, yeah, we showed that a climate climate change legislation was blocked completely in the House of Representatives in 2011. And actually, even more remarkably, the House voted to chop the Environmental Protection Agency budget, overall budget, by 27%, which is one of the biggest cuts ever in that history, in the history of that agency. And about 100, more than 100 members of the House, a good number of them Tea Party Republicans, all voted not to have a single penny spent on anything relating to climate change, or any, you know, regulation of the environment. And, what happened is, they essentially blocked it in the House. The Senate, on the overall EPA budget, it ended up being a total cut of 16% that year. But it also means that all these people signed pledges, very similar to the Grover Norquist no tax pledge, that they would not in any way support this. And it means that climate change will not come through the Congress anytime soon because of this. So the influence, and now, of course, they are in oil and gas and other, they're into many things, the Koch industries, but they're originally known for, most importantly, for oil and gas. And so, of course, they're not in any way interested in climate change. They think that, you know, they're against anything relating to regulation in that area. And that plays directly. And so their commercial lobbyists were talking about this quietly, over lunches and dinners and schmoozing Capitol Hill. And their nonprofits were also testifying during the exact same period of time, 49 or something like that, 49 times on this issue. So they were doing the public thing, the private schmooze thing, and the political contribution thing. I should mention 75 to 80% of the members of Congress who were voting their way on that whole climate change thing all got contributions from Charles or David Koch. So they flooded the zone of potential influence.
Wow. Wow. And they did this both through think tanks and universities?
Yeah, most of, now some of the think tanks, I mean some of the nonprofit policy groups, also known sometimes as think tanks, they, some of them are at universities. There's no university they have supported more in the United States by far than George Mason University. There are two think tanks, Institute for Human Studies and the Mercatus Center. And those two plus George Mason University itself together received about $29 or $30 million, just them alone. And that over, you know, is far, far more than any of the other universities combined. There are 221 universities in 5 years that have gotten money from them, and much of the money is with a kind of an agenda, sort of an ideological agenda about free enterprise and no regulation and all of these kinds of things.
So we'll give money to your college if you'll teach our ideology?
Yeah, pretty much. You and they'll name the lecture. They require, in some cases, the lectures have to be named after the Koch lectures on the various subjects. So yes, there's a very heavy hand, and there's been some controversies in some universities in the country about it, where there's been pushback from the faculty or from the students or from the public. So but I actually had no idea that they were supporting that many universities, and they were surprising universities, not just, you know, small, small, I guess you'd say, colleges really that might be sort of libertarian leaning or, you know, in parts of the country where they have more support. They were actually urban centers that were, you know, not exactly remotely predictable.
Mm-hmm.
So they are spreading the word in ways that I don't think any of us realize.
Wow. And where do you see this going? We're talking with Professor Charles Lewis, who is the executive editor of the Investigating Reporting Workshop, the American University School of Communication, professor of journalism, author of 5 books, investigativereportingworkshop.org, about this report that he wrote along with 3 others, titled The Koch Club. And Koch is spelled, you know, the old mayor of New York used to pronounce it Koch, K-O-C-H.
Right.
And, in fact, I'm guessing that this is simply the way their family has always named their name, although I've had callers call in and say, no, they call themselves Koch so that people won't be able to easily find them on the Internet. People type in C-O-K-E. But in any case, the Koch brothers, the Koch brothers, whatever you want to call them, where in the minute we have left, where do you see them going? Are they ramping up their activities or are they starting to scale back?
No, they're ramping up. We have one of the articles in this package of things we've written with maps and all kinds of graphics. We show that in 1996 they were active in 27 congressional races. This time they're giving to over 100 races in the country. So that's just the political part. You add the universities and the nonprofits. They're far. This is the 2012 and the last few years have been the biggest imprint they've made on American politics, and including academia and these other places. So they are getting more aggressive as they also become more wealthy.
Very quickly, is there anything on the left to compare to this?
No. The short answer is
okay.
No. Well, there are a lot of groups out there saying a lot of things, but on issues like the environment or any other major issue, you have a lot of public interest groups and individual donors who lean towards say the Democratic Party, but there's no evidence they're benefiting from their own advocacy or political and ideology.
Great. Professor Charles Lewis, thank you for being with us, sir.
Sure. Thank you.
Great speaking with you.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And be sure to check out his website over at investigativereportingworkshop.org. Past the hour. You ever heard of Abdullah Haider Shay? He was I may be mispronouncing it. I don't think so. He's a Yemeni journalist, a reporter, an actual reporter, who went out and interviewed some members of Al-Qaeda who told him about a U.S. drone strike that killed 36 women and children. He took the information about that U.S. drone strike and reported it, and that report was picked up by the Washington Post, ABC News, and the New York Times. You with me on this? This guy's a journalist. Horribly embarrassing the Obama administration. They had a conversation with the government in Yemen. Yemen picked up Mr. Abdullah Haider Shay, charged him with consorting with terrorists because he had interviewed the Al-Qaeda people for the information on the drone strike, and convicted him of this and sentenced him to 5 years in prison. He sat in jail for 3 years. This was 3 years ago. He sat in jail for 3 years, and he got out this week. Good behavior, early time out. So Jeremy Scahill sent a request to the White House saying, what's your position on this? What do you think about this? And the White House's official response was to say that they were, quote, concerned and disappointed, end quote, that he had been let out. We are concerned and disappointed by the early release of Abdullah Al-Shay, who was sentenced by a Yemeni court to 5 years in prison for his involvement with Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, quote, end quote. As Jeremy Scahill points out, and other journalists who have followed this story, quote, Shay's only involvement, this is from a piece written by Jacob Chamberlain over at Common Dreams, Shay's only involvement with Al-Qaeda was conducting interviews with their members for major news outlets that included the Washington Post, ABC News, and the New York Times. His legal troubles only arose after he uncovered the deadly U.S. strike that killed dozens of innocent Yemeni civilians, after which he was thrown in prison. At one point, he was slated for early release, but a phone call from President Obama urged Yemeni officials to keep him behind bars. Jeremy Scahill says of the White House's response, we should let that statement set in. The White House is saying that they are disappointed and concerned that a Yemeni journalist has been released from a Yemeni prison. I will not comment further on that. I don't think I need to. Anyhow, it's Anything Goes Friday, so let's pick up your calls. Paul in Woodinville, Washington. Hey, Paul.
Hey, Tom. I wanted to say that I was born and raised in Detroit, and it occurred to me I guess a trivia fact, but it was this very week, 23rd of July through the 27th, 46 years ago, in the summer of 1967, that the Detroit riots occurred.
That was 67?
Yeah.
Huh. OK. Okay.
And it occurred to me, what is the bigger blight on Detroit? And I would say that what just transpired this week is a far greater blight on Detroit.
Yeah, worse than the riots. Well, the riots were confined to just, you know, a dozen or so square blocks.
Yeah, I was there, actually. My dad, who is a jazz musician, played a show at the State Fair Coliseum for the National Guard troops that were called in to, you know, to keep order.
Mm-hmm.
So my dad loves Detroit. He's the greatest fan of Detroit. He's in his mid-80s now.
Mm-hmm.
And I was raised with the notion and the belief that Detroit was a great city. And, you know, I have to say, when I heard the words of Rick Snyder, and by the way, Rick Snyder and I are about the same age, he said that Detroit...
The Republican governor of Michigan.
Yeah, that's right. He said that Detroit's been going down the tubes for 60 years. So apparently he has a different idea about Detroit than I was raised. So what he really thinks is that Detroit has been going down the tubes since before he or I was born. Since the Detroit Lions were a great football dynasty, Detroit's been going down the tubes. Since the days when the Detroit Tigers, all the players on the team, were from Detroit.
Hmm.
He says Detroit was going down the tubes when Jerome Kavanaugh was the mayor. Jerome Kavanaugh had been compared to JFK. He says Detroit was going down the tubes when George Romney was the governor of Michigan. He says Detroit was going down the tubes during the Motown era, during the muscle car era. That's how much pride Rick Snyder has in Michigan. And he's the governor. Why would a guy run for governor of Michigan who has such an ill opinion of its one and only major and greatest city? That's what he thinks. How anybody in Michigan could vote for a guy who would say that about Detroit, I don't care if you're a Democrat or a Republican, that's beyond me. That's offensive. That offends me, and I live in Seattle. I've been gone from Detroit for 23 years.
And it offends you. Yeah, I share your offendedness, Paul. Thank you. Thank you for the call, and thanks for listening to KBCS. Charles in Opa-locka, Florida. Got a minute to the break, Charles. It's yours.
Okay, great, because I'm running out of time on my phone anyway. But I just wanted to say two things. Last night, I was listening to Brett Baer on Fox.
Yeah, if you can take us off speakerphone, it'll sound a lot better. You were listening to Brett Baer on Fox last night?
Yeah, that's better? Okay. Last night, I was listening to Brett Baer on Fox News.
Yep.
And he was talking to a Democrat, and his response to Eric Holder was something of that nature. How can Eric Holder... go against the Supreme Court's ruling on the Voting Rights Act.
Mm-hmm.
And my question to him was, well, as far as the Affordable Care Act is concerned, that's laid law in the land, and how come Republican congressmen voted over and over to repeal something that's already law?
Yeah. Well, the simple answer, Charles, is it's all politics. Even the Supreme Court has become politicized. There's so much billionaire money sloshing around in Washington, D.C., and they're doing so much to damage this country. It is mind-boggling. Your comparison or your pointing out the hypocrisy, you know, between these two situations is spot on. Charles, thanks a lot for the call, and thanks for listening on TuneIn Radio. It is 28 minutes past the hour here on the Tom Hartman Program. One of our callers today going to get a free autographed copy of my book, Cracking the Code.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And that free book will be sent to you by courtesy of Stamps.com. Cracking the Code, How to Win Hearts, Change Minds, and Restore America's Original Vision. Mainstream media, 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Tom Hartman here with you. It's Anything Goes Friday and our Anything Goes Summer.
Yeah.
And, there's a lot going on. We'll pick up some news stories as we continue through the day. But, Ed, in Erie, Pennsylvania, you wanted to talk about the House Un-American Activities Committee?
Yes, I do.
Okay, go for it.
Love you and your staff.
Thank you.
Since we have the NSI recording all of our phone records.
Mm-hmm.
I'd kind of like to hear what my representatives are saying to their lobbyists. I thought if we reunited the Un-American Activities Committee, we put a dozen voters in each state, you know, they can investigate politicians, businesses, the Koch brothers,
yeah.
You know, everybody. And so we could just check out their phone records, you know, all the donations and deals they make,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, find out about this Monsanto Forgiveness Act, you know? put it all right down on paper and put it in the newspaper so people can read it, put it on the internet so people can read it. And then we can make our decision on who we elect for office right from the facts.
Right.
Instead of from what they say.
Right. You know, there actually is, there's an interest. I realize that there's a certain level of facetiousness in what you're suggesting, Ed, but, and maybe a little, not more than a little bit of sarcasm, but, Don Siegelman was put in prison for bribery, and what he did, and he's still sitting there, and what he did was he put, Richard Scrushy, I believe his name was, he appointed him to a unpaid position on the board that oversees hospitals in the state of Alabama when Don Siegelman was the governor of Alabama. Don is a Democrat. And Scrushy had given a $500,000 contribution to a completely independent nonprofit that Don Siegelman had nothing to do with that was trying to get a lottery in the state of Alabama to pay for education for Alabama kids. Now, Don Siegelman supported that idea. It was opposed by Karl Rove. It was opposed by Jack Abramoff. It was opposed by the Ralph Reed. It was opposed by that whole corrupt cabal. And Karl Rove's best friend was the husband of the woman who prosecuted Don Siegelman. But he was put in jail for bribery for appointing somebody to an office who did not give one penny to Don Siegelman. Or anything, you know, Don Siegelman was not enriched in any way by this, and yet he went to jail. So I would submit to you that virtually every politician in America who has ever gotten a campaign contribution from any corporation at all, and then has voted on legislation that has any kind of impact whatsoever on that corporation, which is, by the way, virtually every politician in America, with probably a few singular exceptions like Jan Schakowsky or Bernie Sanders or Senator Sherrod Brown, people like that. But the vast majority of politicians have done this. All of them, I would say, right now, as long as Don Siegelman sits in jail, and you can read the whole thing over at free-don.com, as long as Don Siegelman sits in jail, all of these politicians could easily be put in jail for basically taking money from lobbyists.
Right. I'm telling you, if we got the phone records from the NSA, we could hang
NSA, yeah.
half the Republicans in the House of Representatives right now.
Yeah, so maybe we need to convene a people's grand jury and like Larry Klayman is doing, you know, down in Florida, and start going after some of these people, or start really, really pushing the Justice Department or state prosecutors to say, hey, let's go after some of these politicians who are doing far worse than Don Siegelman ever did. I mean, Don Siegelman didn't make a penny. His campaign didn't even get anything from this guy. And whereas you've got politicians all across this country who are taking money from corporations and fat cats like the Koch brothers, who are CEOs of or whatever their role is with Koch Industries, who are profiting tremendously from the actions of the politicians that they've basically bought and sold. So I think that there's a precedent for putting politicians in jail, and we need to speak loudly about it. Ed, thanks a lot for the call. John in Venice, California. Hey, John, what's up?
Hi, Tom. It's so nice to talk to you, and I thank all of your brilliant listeners for what they share. I was calling about how, you know, even a good thing can go bad, like Bill Maher was recently, I think, advancing the cause of civil rights of atheists. And he read something on his program about, well, it was from a book that a neurobiologist had read about a near-death experience, and he described his experience of being like a speck of energy on the wings of a butterfly. There were multitudes of butterflies all heading towards the same light. And he ridiculed it. And equated it to how all the people in the house with advanced degrees are idiots. And he was making fun of the idea of heaven, I guess. And after you read that beautiful interview, from your friend.
With Michael Hutchison.
Michael Hutchison. Thank you so much for your personal and public memorial of him. It was so, so touching. But I couldn't help but want to call and, I don't know, just,
relate my romantic notion of heaven is exactly what this neurobiologist describes of his experience, which is that we return to energy, and if we take anything with us from this experience of Earth, it's our orientation towards the light that perhaps we've cultivated consciously.
Mm-hmm.
And he described it perfectly, and you read it from Michael Hutchinson, I believe, something very similar about being energy, being spirit,
mm-hmm.
Having an opportunity to just float with each other in and out of our orientation towards the light. And you said he kept his personality. He wasn't always perfect.
No, far from it.
He did practice this orientation towards a conscious connection with his source, I guess you'd call it.
Yeah.
So I think Bill Maher's fabulous, brilliant, funny. I wish I could talk about politics with a sense of humor. I really want to develop that.
Yeah.
People don't want to talk about politics with me. I'm no fun. And he's fun.
Yeah.
But it was a good example of how people could, in advancing a cause, go to the extreme. And I would hate to see any of us liberals become radicals. And he did that by alienating agnosticism.
Mm-hmm.
Why not be open to that description of?
Yeah, things? You know, I've long, and if you've watched Bill's movie Religious, you know he's ridiculing religion, and you know when it comes to organized religion, there's a lot to ridicule. it really is, but when it comes to personal spirituality, I don't think there's anything to ridicule, and I think people really should be let to, and perhaps even encouraged to follow their own paths and find their own ways. And if an organized religion helps them get there, I say more power to them. And on the other hand, if atheism helps them get there, who was the Carl Sagan, where he described these kinds of deep, profound experiences that he had, but he had them looking through telescopes. And, you know, if that's what gets you there, cool. Science was what turned on Carl Sagan. I interviewed his widow about a year and a half ago, I think, on this program. And it's like, whatever it may be. And I think Bill has gone a little far on that. But, you know, the guy does so much good, and he's really so funny. I had such a great time on his show a couple years ago. And he's, I'm not going to pick on him for it. I get your point. John, thanks a lot for the call. Deidre in Congress, Arizona. Hey, Deidre, you wanted to talk about 9/11?
Yeah. I was going to say I think you're wrong about that, about Bush.
Okay, if I may encapsulate my theory, Deidre, before you go, because a lot of people didn't hear what I had to say, I'll do it in just a sentence. I think Bush knew something horrible was going to happen. I think he stayed away from Washington, D.C. and New York City in order to avoid being where it happened. I think he was frightened, and that's why he went to Florida, and he took the longest vacation in the history of the U.S. presidency. And I think once it happened, he exploited it for everything he could to get us into Iraq, which had nothing to do with 9/11. That said, my personal opinion is that Bush did not set up 9/11. Okay, now off to you.
I told him that.
I beg your pardon?
They didn't want to listen. They kind of wanted it to happen. They needed a Pearl Harbor event.
Yeah.
In the beginning, Bush said Saddam Hussein did this. Iraq did this.
Oh, he never said that. He just let people infer that.
No, he did say it. I heard him say it.
Are you sure?
He did say it, yes. I watched everything I could on this. I watched Nightline from everything there was. And when Ted Koppel was on Nightline before he retired a year or so, just as we were starting to go into Iraq, Joe Wilson told about his trips to Niger regarding
mm-hmm.
Yellow Cake.
Yep.
You know, his wife worked there as a CIA operative. She said, no, Yellow Cake was not going to Iraq. The CIA said, don't say that. Those 16 words, don't say that. But Bush said it, that Yellow Cake was being shipped to Iraq. It was not.
Right.
They needed a reason to go to Iraq.
I agree.
He wanted to get Saddam Hussein.
I agree.
For trying to kill his father in Kuwait. They wanted the oil fields. They had the maps of the oil fields laid
yep.
out.
Cheney was doing that, yep.
Yes.
In April of 2001.
Yes. And this was a reason to go to Iraq.
Yes,
this
I agree.
Was, you know,
I agree.
Probably the right guy.
The question, Deidre, is, was Bush behind it or not? And that's where I can't, that's a line I can't step over. I just can't wrap my head around that enough to step over it. Are you thinking that Bush was behind it?
They both were.
Okay. All right. Well, you know, there's a variety of opinions here in this country. I respect all of them. I think it's going to be a long time before we really know for sure. Deidre, thank you for your call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
So I think Bush was just an good old-fashioned opportunist when it came to 9/11. And a frightened, scared little boy before. 10 minutes before the hour, welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And let's check in with the Talk Radio News Service. TalkRadioNews.com, brought to you by GoatsForTheOldGoat.com to find out what's going on. Victoria Jones. Hey, Victoria.
Hey, Tom.
So what's up in the world today?
Well, the U.S. intends to repatriate two detainees held at Guantanamo to Algeria, the White House said today.
Well, that's a good start.
Well, it will be the first such transfer in nearly a year, and it's meant to show the Obama administration's commitment to closing the prison.
That's great. Are these people who have been adjudicated not guilty of anything here by OOPS?
Well, they're people who've been cleared for release. That's the right. only information that I have about them at this point.
Okay.
So, presumably, they're okay. It's interesting that I think that the White House picked Algeria. There are over 50 men who've been cleared for release to Yemen, but I think Yemen would have been just very controversial.
Yeah, especially since they just released that journalist. You know, you heard that story?
Yes. Yeah. Yes, I'm sorry to disappear off the screen, but I just realized I printed out some comments from Dianne Feinstein I wanted to share with you.
Oh, okay. Go for it.
She said that she backed the Guantanamo transfer, said that the two detainees were cleared for transfer years ago. And she's also lamenting the $454 million annual Guantanamo operational cost. And she's calling for repatriation of the 84 detainees also cleared for transfer.
Right. Repatriation being a big fancy word that means let's send them home.
Yeah, send them home.
Yep.
Get them out. And it's a way to start closing down the prison. Of course, it is complicated because there are some people who they cannot, they believe, send home. Because
right.
they're people who they just do not think are safe to be sent home. And that's where it starts to get complicated. Because Republicans in Congress and Democrats in Congress have imposed restrictions on transfers from the camp, including a ban on any of the prisoners being brought to the U.S., which is
yeah.
why it gets difficult to close it down, as you know.
Yes, yes.
Attorney General Eric Holder told a Russian official that the U.S. will not seek the death penalty for Edward Snowden and won't torture him.
Oh, well, that's reassuring.
Yes, and he would be promptly brought before a civilian court, and he would have the right to an attorney and to an appeal if he were convicted.
Okay. And the Russians have responded how?
In other words, send him back.
Right. And the response from the Russians was?
Well, the response from the Russians was kind of interesting. Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov said on Friday, "We have never surrendered anyone, and we will never do so in the future." But Peskov also said that President Putin doesn't want the Snowden drama to harm U.S.-Russian relations. Putin has demonstrated strong resolve to prevent this. I just think they want him to go away.
Yeah, so why don't they give him a 24-hour pass? Let him get to the embassy. Well, actually, though, then he's holed up just like, you know, what's his name? Is holed up in the...
Sands. He's stuck in somebody else's embassy.
Yeah, but he's in the U.K., and this way he would be in an embassy in Russia. Although, at least if he's in an embassy, you know, Putin could genuinely say, sorry, he's not on our soil. I mean, now the airport thing is getting a little thin, you know?
Getting a little thin. And, in fact, the Russians said today... that, and I thought this was very interesting and sounded very Soviet to me. The head of the public counsel of the Russian Federal Migration Service, Vladimir Volok, said today that Snowden could be stuck in the transit area for up to 6 months as officials review his legal situation. The procedures to determine his legal status are underway. We know that he is Edward Snowden only from his words. The passport he had has been cancelled. He is under protection in the transit area for his safety. He is an individual being pursued, and his life is in danger.
Yes, well, that's true, I think.
Yeah, but there are several contradictions in what that gentleman is saying. It sounded very, very 1970s to me.
Yeah, yeah. Spy versus spy. This is interesting. Not to say that Edward Snowden is the spy, just the kind of the old language of the Gromyko or Khrushchev versus Kennedy or LBJ. Yeah, interesting.
Also, tens of thousands of supporters and opponents of Egypt's ousted Islamic president are continuing into the night with rallies, and five people have been killed in Alexandria.
Mm-hmm.
And these are pretty serious rallies because the head of the army, General Sisi, has given the Muslim Brotherhood a deadline of tomorrow to basically get in line. And nobody knows what that means. If they don't get in line, whatever that means. Also, earlier today, Sisi had President Morsi, the ousted president, detained for 15 days for questioning. He's accused of conspiring with Palestinian militant group Hamas during the 2011 uprising in terms of how he got out of jail.
Hmm.
Muslim Brotherhood denied this absolutely.
Yeah, interesting.
The unions are asking President Obama for a Detroit bailout. The executive council of the AFL-CIO is calling for an immediate infusion of federal assistance for Detroit.
Now, did we bail out New York City, or did we almost bail out New York City?
I don't think we bailed out New York City.
Okay. It was like during the Koch administration, wasn't it?
Yeah, I don't think we did that.
Okay. All right.
So he's asking for that. Meantime, John Cornyn, Senator John Cornyn, has introduced an amendment to appropriations legislation that would ban the federal government bailing out financially troubled cities.
Including
and
Detroit.
And so is Lindsey Graham.
Yeah. Well, of course, the Republicans are loving this. This is their talking point. Hey, look at what happens when organized labor, Democrats, and in particular African-Americans run an American city. I mean, they're not pointing out that San Francisco has been Democratic forever, but this, and many others. But anyway, this is so sad. Victoria, thank you for the report today.
Thank you very much. Have a great weekend.
Thank you, and the very best to you too. Talk Radio News Service brought to you, Victoria Jones, brought to you by GoatsForTheOldGoat.com. It's Anything Goes Friday here on the Tom Hartman Program. One more hour in our show, and was Bush behind 9/11? Really?
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. It's Anything Goes Friday, and so, I purposely brought up 9/11. For a long, long time, we've tried, I just generally try to avoid a discussion of it, because it's one of the, it's like going down the rabbit hole, and, everybody has an opinion, but I just want to say, because people call in about it on a fairly regular basis, and if you want to do that today, and we've got a lot of calls on a lot of other topics, we don't have to, but I look at the situation, and having spent 17 years researching the JFK assassination, work that Lamar Waldron and I did that produced two 900-page books, one of which has been made into an hour-long NBC Discovery Channel documentary called The Men Who Killed Kennedy, and the other of which is slated to be made into a movie with Leonardo DiCaprio and Robert De Niro by Warner Brothers. So, somebody has taken us seriously. 50 years after the fact, more or less, I can tell you that it took a long time to, for us to figure out what had happened. And in fact, we had a pretty good inkling of our idea of what happened with the Kennedy assassination about 12 or 15 years ago. We started out on the assumption that the CIA was involved, and we ended up disproving ourselves. And we were not trying, you know, we were not engaged in a tautology. We were not trying to prove our theory. We were kind of suspicious of that, but, or just speaking for myself. I can't speak for Lamar, but speaking for myself, I was suspicious of that. And, you know, the kind of Oliver Stone theory. But, or the military-industrial complex or something, you know, like something like that. And what we ended up not just figuring out, but I think, you know, proving fairly clearly, particularly now that we've got the FBI tapes of Carlos Marcello confessing to it, that it was the mob who killed Kennedy. And they did it because prior to the Kennedy administration, there had never been more than 15 prosecutions of organized crime in this country in any one year. Nixon was in the bag with the mob. The mob was doing just fine, thank you very much. They were blackmailing Hoover. They had the best of all worlds. They were blackmailing Hoover about his homosexuality. And then Bobby Kennedy comes in, and he has over 700 prosecutions of the mafia in the first year of the Kennedy administration. He was putting them out of business. And how does the mob kill people? They do big public hits. It's like, you know, the two guys who, in my mind, were responsible for it were Carlos Marcello and Santo Trafficante. And Trafficante was the guy who was involved in going up to New York City and killing Albert Anastasia in the barber chair in New York City, you know, walking with a machine gun and just... And that's how the mob killed people. But anyhow, my point is it took us all these years to get to that point of talking to people who were inside the mob, people who were inside the CIA, people who were inside the Kennedy administration, talking with Dave Powers, who was one of his closest aides, long conversations with Dave. He gave me an autographed copy of Life magazine. I sat in Jack's rocking chair as I was talking with him, the one from the Oval Office. Dave Powers at the time was the head of the Kennedy Library in Boston. I think we nailed it down. But it took 50 years. And our work was done on the shoulders of all kinds of people. You know, Anthony Summers and Albert, you know, he was one of the very first, and many, many other people who had, you know, Mark Lane, everybody's work that had preceded us. We didn't do it out of a vacuum. In fact, the House, the House Committee on Assassinations, they concluded 20 plus years ago that the Kennedy assassination was the result of a conspiracy. Most Americans don't know this. There was the Warren Commission that said it was a lone gunman, and then, you know, a couple of decades later, the House of Representatives convened a committee, looked into this, and actually came to a formal conclusion. So this is the official statement of the United States government. The most recent one was that Kennedy was killed as a result of a conspiracy, and that Oswald was not working alone, and in fact could not have been working alone. So anyhow, after all of that, we think we figured it out. And having been through that, and having, you know, Lamar probably has 2 million pieces of paper in his house, and megabyte after megabyte after gigabytes, terabytes of computer files and interviews, and we traveled all over the world. I went to France trying to track down Michael Mertz. You know, who we thought was one of the assassins. It just went on and on and on. So I look at people who are trying to figure out what happened on 9/11, and I just say, good luck, God bless you. Because I don't think we really know. Now, my personal opinion, and this is subject to change, because when we started looking into the Kennedy assassination, I thought it was the CIA and the military-industrial complex, and I no longer believe that at all. But my personal opinion, based on no personal research, just reading everything I've seen Zeitgeist. I've seen all the movies. I've seen the engineer's report. I've seen it all. My personal opinion is that George W. Bush, Dick Cheney, knew something was up. Now, I base that on Sandy Berger personally telling me, one-on-one. Sandy Berger had been the national security advisor. He had Condoleezza Rice's job in the Bill Clinton administration, personally telling me that when he left office and in handed that office over to George W. Bush in January 2001, that and handed his office off to Condoleezza Rice, that he personally told Condoleezza Rice, Your number one priority has to be Osama bin Laden. Just a few months earlier, Bill Clinton had tried to hit, or maybe a year earlier, Bill Clinton had tried to hit Osama bin Laden in Afghanistan with three cruise missiles, missed him by 20 minutes, and the Republicans went to the floor of the House of Representatives, I believe it was Newt, it could have been somebody else, to ridicule Bill Clinton for that, saying, oh, he's trying to wag the dog, he's trying to take our minds off of Monica Lewinsky. And so what we know is that, and this is like public record stuff, is that in January of 2001, when the Bush administration started, George W. Bush gave two jobs to Dick Cheney. One was to head up the Energy Task Force. And what was he doing in the Energy Task Force? Dividing up the oil fields of Iraq. Larry Klayman from Judicial Watch filed a Freedom of Information lawsuit and actually got the paperwork. You can find it online. That's what Dick Cheney was doing. He was meeting in secret with oil companies, no environmentalists whatsoever, oil companies from around the world, and they were deciding which oil fields in Iraq were going to go to which countries and which companies. And then the second thing Dick Cheney was given as a job as vice president was to be in charge of the counterterrorism task force, which he never bothered to convene until September of 2001. So Cheney took his eye off the ball. Condi Rice took her eye off the ball. And George W. Bush was down in Texas, and finally the CIA was running around, you know, Richard Clark talking about how they had their hair on fire. They saw this coming. Again, they weren't certain what it was, who it was going to be. They just knew it was going to be big, and it was going to be New York or Washington, and they got this from British intelligence, Russian intelligence, Israeli intelligence, not to mention our own intelligence. CIA sends a guy down to Crawford, Texas, with a memo titled, Bin Laden determined to strike inside the U.S. and makes sure that George Bush reads it, because they were starting to assume that he wasn't even reading these things because he wasn't doing anything. And I think he was just scared to death. He was in Crawford. He was way away from Washington and New York. He knew something terrible was going to happen. He probably thought it was going to be a Tim McVeigh kind of thing, blow up a building. And he was afraid to go back. So he took the longest vacation in the history of the U.S. presidency all the way back to George Washington. And then when that was over, he went to Florida, the state that his brother was running, and said, hide me, Jeb, until something terrible happens and it's over. And Jeb did. And then after 9/11, which I think could have been avoided if Dick Cheney had done his job, if Condi Rice had done her job, if George Bush had done his job, after 9/11, he shamelessly used it to invade a country that had nothing to do with 9/11. That's my opinion.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So just to get it out of the way, it's the summer. It's kind of a slow news day. What the heck? But we've got a lot of other things to talk about, too. So I'll be picking up your calls right after this. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Paul in San Francisco. Hey, Paul, what's up?
Hey, Tom, you know, usually I call you about the Republicans trying to bankrupt the Postal Service.
Mm-hmm.
But today, since it's anything goes, I was sitting here listening to your program, and the Geeky Science song popped into my head, and
oh, yeah.
I was humming along. Where do I get the Geeky Science song? What's the name of it?
I don't know, but I see Shane banging away at the keyboard. It's called Geeky Science. No, I think Geeky Science Rocks is the title that we put on that MP3. It's just a fragment of a popular song. I don't know, Paul. I'm sorry I don't know off the top of my head, but I just don't know. I'm guessing if you check into the chat room or check on the message boards, post a thing on the message boards asking, that somebody will know. But it was years and years ago that we cut that out as a bumper. And lately, we've not been able to use it as a bumper because when we started carrying the show live on television as well as radio, we had to change the music that we use. So we use all licensed music now rather than because the rules for fair use under ASCAP and BMI are different from radio than from television. So it's kind of a weird thing, but we don't use that song anymore. So you've been listening for a while. But
need to bring it back.
yeah. So post it. Start a thread over in the message board. I'm guessing somebody would know. Okay?
All right.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Paul. Thanks for the call. Good to hear from you. Wayne in Chicago. Hey, Wayne, what's up?
Hi. Good afternoon, Tom.
Hey, Wayne.
Yes.
Nice to hear your voice.
Yes, I haven't talked to you for a while. Good to talk to you again.
Thank you.
Listen, I've been listening to you, which I do almost every day. Do you really think that the mafia killed King, although not King, killed Kennedy alone? They even asked George Bush, a reporter asked him, well, where were you when Kennedy got killed? He said he wasn't in Dallas. They found out he was in Dallas.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. I actually do, but there was the cover-up. The cover-up was done by the U.S. government, and here's why. If you want to get into this conversation, the Kennedy, you know, Bobby and Jack were planning. They had two parallel programs going on with regard to Cuba, because the 64 election was coming, and Richard Nixon in 63, 62, in fact, was already beating up the Kennedys over Cuba. You know, Jack Kennedy beat up Nixon in the 60 election about how Nixon let Cuba go communist in 58, 59, and then, you know, Nixon was doing the same thing. So they had two programs going. One was a rapprochement program. They were trying to achieve a political peace with Castro to normalize relations. The other was kind of a plan B, which was on December 5th of 1963. They had been approached by the number three guy in the Cuban government, a fellow by the name of Almeida, who said he was in charge of the army, and who said that Castro had betrayed the revolution by going with the Soviets, and that if somebody were to kill him, he would be glad to step in and establish a positive relationship with the United States. So there was, and this was being run basically off the shelf out of the Department of Justice, and or out of, you know, out of Bobby Kennedy's office, and you know, without the knowledge of pretty much anybody else, except that there was this one guy, Bernard Barker, who, you know, actually E. Howard Hunt, Bobby had to turn to, or the people around him actually had to turn to for some information. Hunt was the number three guy in the CIA at the time, or was high up in the CIA, and he had an assistant, Bernard Barker, and what he didn't know is that Barker was a previous hitman for Santos Traficante. So the story of this hit on December 5th, 63 on Castro got leaked to the mob. Now, meanwhile, the Kennedy administration is thinking, okay, if we are successful, if Castro finds out that we're trying to kill him, then he might retaliate. And if he retaliates, it would probably be something like he would assassinate the U.S. ambassador to Guatemala or the U.S. ambassador to Honduras or some other, you know, this Spanish language nation. That was what they were expecting. So Al Haig drafted this thing called the Cuba Contingency Plan. We've got the document. It's in the book. You can see his signature on it, which said that if the U.S. government thought that Castro was responsible for killing any American official, then that had to be immediately buried, because if it got out to the American people in the 60s, in 63, that Castro had killed one of our officials, there would be such a hue and cry for retaliation that we would have to invade Cuba, and that would provoke Khrushchev to actually send nuclear bombs to the United States. Kennedy was certain of that. And that would be a disaster, an unmitigated disaster that they couldn't allow. So what happened was, when the assassination happened, the mob organized it because they knew about the Cuba contingency plan and they knew about the plan to kill Castro. They organized it to look like Lee Oswald, who had been involved in the plan, you know, the plan to kill Castro. They organized it to make it look like one of, you know, the plan guys was involved in killing Kennedy. Therefore, Castro must have put him up to it. So as soon as LBJ came to the conclusion, and he came to that conclusion within a day, and the entire Johnson administration, that Castro had been responsible for killing Kennedy, then the Cuba contingency plan kicked in, and that's why you see Earl Warren walking out of LBJ's office with tears streaming down his eyes, because he's just been told he's got to cover up the crime of the century, because we can't let the American people know that Castro killed the president, because that's what they believed at the time, and that's what Bobby believed for several months. And it took a while for Bobby to figure out that it wasn't Castro. But that's why they did the whole cover-up. That's why the whole Warren Commission cover-up. And yes, the CIA was involved in the cover-up, the FBI, the whole thing, because they thought they were trying to prevent World War III. Am I making sense, Wayne?
No. The Kennedy brothers had, they had said that they were going to completely dismantle the CIA.
Nah, not so much. I mean, you know, Jack was very, very PO'd at the CIA after the Bay of Pigs disaster. But no, there was not a threat to completely dismantle it. There were careers that were hurt. E. Howard Hunt's was one of them, hurt very badly over the Bay of Pigs. But that's a quote out of context that it doesn't have the significance that is worth killing a president over. Wayne, thank you for the call. We'll have to carry on this conversation another time.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
It's a fascinating topic, and like I said, if you know, the Discovery Channel has this documentary that Lamar and I are most of, called The Men Who Killed Kennedy. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Okay, three corrections, if I may. The first is we had a caller call in and say, hey, the president of Whole Foods has a new book out. Why don't you get him on? And I said, yeah, sounds like a good idea. And Sean, our executive producer, Sean Taylor, contacted Shano to let me know that he was doing his book tour. He was in Los Angeles. We have a studio in Los Angeles. We could have brought him in with, you know, very good quality video and everything else, and offered to put him on the air. And his publicist said, no, he's not interested in being on your show. So, there's that. And which is, you know, fine. As I said, we very rarely do authors, and it's pretty much not an interview show anyway, so that's fine. Number two, somebody asked, what did we used to use as our geeky science song? It's, Shano tracked this one down on the internet over on Amazon. It's called Science Rocks. It's by Rock Chick and Science Geek, and it's from the album Science Rocks. So, just for your information. And number three, Bernie wanted me to share a clarification with you. I got an email from his office asking me, he says, Bernie asked me to send along a clarification for a caller who asked about health care. This was the caller from North Carolina who said, you know, if my governor doesn't go along with the Medicaid expansion with Obamacare and I don't have available to me cheap health care through that, are they going to put me in jail or something? Have I committed a crime? And Bernie said, no, they're not going to do that. Here's the whole answer. He writes, if a state such as North Carolina chooses not to set up its own exchange, the federal government will come in and run one for the residents of that state starting October 1st of this year. People in that state, in this case North Carolina, will have to purchase insurance through the exchange or pay a fine. However, there is a special exception for certain low-income people because North Carolina and several other states have chosen not to expand their Medicaid programs. If a person would have been eligible for expanded Medicaid but cannot access it because the state is not expanding their Medicaid program, then that person will not have to pay a fine if they cannot afford health insurance. So that's a fairly comprehensive answer, and thank you, Senator Sanders, for that. It's really nice having talk about a responsive politician. I mean, it's Bernie should be the role model for everybody in Washington, D.C. Pat in Beloit, Wisconsin. Hey, Pat, what's up?
Well, first of all, I appreciate the fact I always said before I died I wanted to know who killed Kennedy because it was such a traumatic event in my life when it happened. I was a teen.
Yeah.
And I don't think the nation of people who were alive at that time probably ever did recover from it.
I agree.
So I appreciate your finding the solution. I'm looking forward to one of the videos. The reason I called is because you talked about the kind of moment or moments that we have sometimes that are, I guess you could call them religious or to a certain extent just something that is different from the rest of your life.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I've had several, one of which was when my first child was born, and the second is when the social worker gave my second child to me as an infant 10 days old.
Wow.
And the third was when I looked at my grandson, the child of the first child I had, and I knew there had to be an eternity because even if there was nothing after life, a portion of myself was in that infant lying in that nursery.
Yes.
And so I think that's one of those game-changing moments. But I find many times when I work with a student, because I work with kids that are maybe not quite as severe as your Hunter School kids, but very severely emotionally and behavior disturbed.
Mm-hmm.
And there are times when you succeed, which isn't often, and you know you've made a difference in somebody's life. I just had a student that I'd had for 6 years this last June, parentless, homeless, everything going against him, but the people who cared about him in the school system. And the week before graduation, he found out he was going to graduate. He was going to make it. And we scrambled and got him a robe, and we got him a tassel, and he looked at me and said, he likes to call me Grandma, and he said, "You will be there, won't you?" And I said, "Oh, yes, of course I will." And you know, he's African American as anybody could be, and I've never seen his color. And I was there, and it was one of those moments when you say, I did really make a difference in somebody's life.
Mm. Yeah.
And teachers do that. I mean, they're fortunate enough to have those experiences.
Mm-hmm.
And a fireman, people who are public servants. And it's so sad to see us blind so, because, you know, we do make a difference in kids' lives and people's lives. And for some reason, the community has been brought down and told that we are not of a great value, and morale amongst us is very poor.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really a tragedy, because most of us don't make that much money. We do it for a greater good, I guess you could say.
Yeah. I think part of the mindset that has enabled those who go after teachers is the idea that schools are factories and children are products. It's a very mechanistic, you know, worldview. It's sort of a variation on the Cartesian worldview, the larger Cartesian worldview, that the entire universe is just a machine, and if we can just figure out, you know, where the gears are and where the levers are, we can do pretty much anything. That science will answer all things, and you know that some people who are super skeptics subscribe to. But
and you know, you have dealt with autistic kids. I mean, that's just one particular group of students. And I've never found two autistic kids that were the same.
Yep.
Much less all these other disabilities and problems that kids come with. I mean, they come with so much baggage to school this day and age. Yep. And sometimes they're hungry. There's no food for the weekend. Yep. You know, sometimes, like I say, they're homeless and they're living on the street. Our school district had over 500 students during the course of last year who were homeless.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, we had one student that lived in, now the high school's a good size, you know, 1,500, almost 2,000 students, but he lived in the building for months, hiding out so that he wouldn't have to leave because he had nowhere to go.
Wow.
And finally somebody found out, and then they did a video about the number of homeless students that we had, and they did a little more looking into it. And it was called 1647, I think, which was the minutes between the time that the day ended and the time that school began again, where these students had nowhere to go.
Wow, that's incredible.
It is, and this is our society today.
We have, or so many of us. Actually, so few of us have lost compassion and lost their connection. It's just that they happen to be the ones who control vast wealth and the corporate and political levers of power in this nation. Because if you look at other countries around the world, that's not so much happening. But that's brilliant. Pat Shano, who is the decider of the capricious decider of who gets a book every day, said that he would like to give you a free copy of Cracking the Code, my book, How to Win Hearts, Change Minds, and Restore America's Original Vision. Would you like one?
Yes, please.
Okay, let me put you on hold, and Jen will pick you up, and she's on line four, Jen. And Jen will pick you up and get your address, and I will autograph it this afternoon, and we'll get it off to you. Thank you very much, Pat. Dean in Fernanda Beach, Florida, you wanted to talk about the Kennedy assassination.
Yeah. Hello, Tom.
Hi, Dean.
I don't know if you remember, but I called you a couple
I guess, last week with the baseball analogy to global warming, and you admitted that you were a Detroit Tigers fan.
Yep.
On your Kennedy assassination theory and all that research you did, I'm afraid you did it all for nothing.
Okay.
Because I know what really happened. Very few of us do. But let me ask you a trivia question first. What did Jack Kennedy do when he did his inauguration and he put his hand up and was sworn in as president? He did something, or shall I say he didn't do something, that all the presidents way back through, I don't know what, he did something different.
Okay, why don't you tell us what that is, Dean?
Him. Excuse me?
Why don't you tell us what that is?
He did not wear a hat.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that was quite famous that he went hatless, yes.
And I remember when I was a kid, we would go with my dad to these big hat warehouses that had nothing but hats.
Yep, yep.
And
so you think the hat industry, the Mad as a Hatters, killed him? We have a little less than a minute, Dean, for you to make a point. Pardon?
The Mad Hatters are the ones who did it. It wasn't
Seriously?
The mob, it wasn't the CIA, it was the Mad
Hatters. Well, you know why the Mad Hatters are called Mad Hatters is because they used to use mercury to form the beaver pelts into those top hats back in Lincoln's day. And the people who handled that mercury all day long went insane from the neurological damage caused by the mercury. The Hatters.
I did not know that.
Yeah, that's where the phrase Mad as a Hatter came from, because people who became hatters, who made hats for a living, they would do it typically for 3, 4, 5, 6 years before they became just nuts. And nobody ever knew why until, you know, we figured out that mercury was a neurotoxin that could actually migrate through the skin. And they used a mercury-based substance to form those beaver pelts into those hats. Anyhow, Dean, thanks for the call. That's a good one. The hat industry guy makes perfect sense. Thank you very much. 15 minutes before the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Ah, the king of all trivia here. It's like, what can I say? It's we'll be right back. It's 15 minutes before the hour. Hey, thanks so much to our show director, Louise Hartman, to my executive producer, Sean Taylor, our associate producers, Shane Farner and Danielle Gilday, to our video director, Jim Javinsky, to our phone screener, Jen Salko, to our writer-researchers, Andrew Campbell and Nate Sweet, to Alva Goldbook for video production, to our webmasters, Nigel Peacock and Jamie Holly, to our business manager, Ron Hartenbaum, to all the folks who syndicate our programs at all the various companies that do that, Dial Global, Pacifica Radio, Sirius XM Satellite Radio, Cable Radio Network, Free Speech TV, on Dish Network, DirecTV, all the cable providers who carry our show, Comcast, Manhattan Neighborhood Network, all the others around the country, to all the great folks at Free Speech TV and RTTV who work on The Big Picture, to our newsletter editor, Sue Nethercutt, to the folks in our chat room, to Ellen Ratner and Victoria Jones and everyone at the Talk Radio News Service, to Jay Goodman Tamboli for tech support, to our affiliates, all the radio and television stations, and even web stations that carry our show, to our sponsors and underwriters, and to you for supporting our program. Thank you. Genuinely. Thank you very much. Bill in Lake Elsinore, California. Hey, Bill, what's up?
Hi, Tom. A brand new convert, and I really appreciate someone on the level finally.
Well, hey, thanks for you're listening on KPFK, the
Roy of Hollywood introduced
Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles. Thank you for calling. Thanks for listening to KPFK.
Somebody I can finally converse with. My point will parallel with Detroit, comparative to Los Angeles area, Southern California here.
Mm-hmm.
A couple weeks ago, a very young caller asked Senator Sanders why these newly established manufacturing companies are having trouble filling positions. I couldn't believe it. Read the grapes of wrath, kid. Bernie said flatly, I don't know. He didn't want to, you know, go into that, but,
sure.
You know, trying to staff millwrights and journeyman machinists for $12, $14 an hour, which is what I earned in the late 70s when Los Angeles was the pinnacle of manufacturing with the Northrop, Rockwell, Hughes, Bell, right. Donald Douglas, all of them were here.
Yeah, and $14 an hour in the 70s was like $30 an hour today.
Sure, absolutely. And high schools could produce certified welders, draftsmen, Class A machinists,
yep.
Believe it or not, and the community colleges.
Yep.
But one day it all just disappeared, just like Detroit. And Detroit was the Los Angeles of the 40s. Now it's just turned all around.
Yep.
And it's all gone, and the city's just a mess.
32 years of Reaganomics and free trade insanity. And a fair dose of racism tossed in on top of it.
And they sweep it under the rug really conveniently.
Yep.
And L.A.'s the worst. Even being Eastern European, my brother's African American and Asian and Hispanic brothers will laugh, but even just having a Slavic last name, they used to, I was the brunt of all of it. Remember the quote unquote Polish jokes?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. One of my best friends was Polish with a very Polish sounding name. And back in the 60s, when the they called them the Polak jokes, I guess, which is a slur. I got it from Jerry's experience, how painful that was. And my father's family was Norwegian, and up in northern Michigan, they tell Norwegian jokes because there's so many of them who had settled up there. But yeah, I got it.
Comparatively, yeah.
Yeah.
But this whole region functioned beautifully then when it was all up and running.
Yeah.
And just one day, just gone, poof, everything.
Yeah.
The only skilled manufacturing people that are working right now are with Northrop Grumman at Newport News, or they train them, GE trains them all in-house now, and that's the one and only place you can go or stay.
Yeah, they're few and far between, and the Machinist Union that my dad's union shop was part of, the Machinist Union, is a shadow of its former self, because we just don't have machinists here anymore. They're doing very, very well in Germany. They're doing very well in Japan. They're doing very well in South Korea and in Taiwan, and increasingly in China. I don't know if the union's any good there, but probably not. But increasingly in Russia and Brazil and the developing countries, India. But this 32 years of Reaganomics and free trade craziness, it is so sad. Thanks a lot for the call. Thanks for listening to KPFK. Jerry in Chicago. Hey, Jerry.
Hey, how you doing?
Great. What's up?
Since Franklin Delano Roosevelt didn't know about all the details behind facilitating the attack on Pearl Harbor, and he couldn't because he had a lot of other things to do, that was left up to the Office of Naval Intelligence.
That's correct.
Similarly,
Dean Rusk, actually, was the guy.
It was the Office of Naval Intelligence. And
Dean Rusk was the guy who was charged with following the fleet. Yeah.
Yeah. Similarly, George Bush Jr. was not really behind 9/11 because he couldn't have been. You have to have a whole phalanx of people below you running all the details.
Yeah. And the other thing that points to the mob is that after the assassination of Kennedy, there was this sudden explosion of murders of people who were members of the mob, who were kind of at the low-level flunky hitman kind of guy who had peripheral involvement with this thing. And this was the mob cleaning up their loose ends, as it were.
Murder of the president was not a federal offense.
No.
Jurisdiction resided in Dallas.
That's correct. And it was
stole the body and took the body to Washington, D.C.
That's right. And that was the Cuba contingency.
Autopsy. Did organized crime arrange that illegal autopsy?
No, that was organized by the Johnson administration. That was the execution. I mentioned earlier Al Haig and the Cuba contingency plan. As soon as they realized that Fidel Castro had killed the president, I mean, would they believe that to be the fact? It was not, but they believed it. As soon as that happened, that Cuba contingency plan kicked into place. And the first part of the Cuba contingency plan is federalize the body and get control of it and even modify, if necessary, the gunshot wounds or whatever so that, we can be ambiguous. We can put out whatever story we want so we can keep the attention away from Castro. Because if Castro is fingered for the assassination of a federal official, like I said, they were expecting it to be the U.S. ambassador to El Salvador. But if Castro was fingered for that, there would be such an outcry in America, particularly on the right, for retaliation against Cuba, that it could lead to World War III. And that's what they all thought they were preventing by federalizing Kennedy's body, by taking it out of Texas, by taking it to Bethesda, the whole thing. It was all to prevent World War III. Jerry, it's all in our book, actually two books, The Legacy of Secrecy and Ultimate Sacrifice. So anyhow, I refer you to them. And not to plug the books, but just, if you really want to dig this stuff out, at least from our point. Coming up Monday, we'll have all the latest news and information from the weekend. Plus, pro-gun groups are gathering money so they can buy a replacement gun for the guy who killed Trayvon Martin. I'll interview Bill Frady of Gun Owners of America and host of Lock and Load Radio about why they want to rearm George Zimmerman. Really?
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.
And don't forget, democracy starts with you. Get out there, get active, tag Yura. We'll see you Monday.